I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. President Bush turned up the heat on the gay marriage battle today, calling for an amendment to the Constitution, which would define marriage as a union between a man and a woman.
Today I call upon the Congress to promptly pass and to send to the states for ratification an amendment to our Constitution defining and protecting marriage as the union of a man and woman as husband and wife.
Bush said the amendment is needed to prevent the meaning of marriage from being changed forever. Joining us to talk about the latest development in the gay marriage controversy is Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
Andrea, what moved George W. Bush from being troubled by gay marriage, as he's repeatedly said he was in recent weeks, to now calling for a constitutional amendment banning it?
Politics. Last night, the president opened up his campaign for reelection in a very stinging speech, and I think this is round two today. He's been saying for a while, he's been promising Republicans and especially conservatives that he was going to come out on this issue, and I think after a couple of weeks of watching people of gays lined up in San Francisco and kissing on TV, that he just had to do it.
But is there a political downside? There are people who support gay marriage. Or is it just all in numbers like the CNN poll most recently, 64% opposing gay marriage, 32% for it?
I think a lot of this has to do with semantics. He did leave himself an out. He didn't. He said we would leave it up to the states to provide homosexuals with other legal arrangements. So he's not banning civil unions. It's not what he wants to do. John Kerry, who is the front runner in the Democratic race right now, has said himself that he's not in favor of gay marriage, that he favors civil unions. And so this way, the president can sort of play to his base of conservatives while at the same time saying, I'm a compassionate conservative and I'm still leaving the door open for civil unions.
Though Kerry, of course, opposes a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, so there is a difference
right there.
But as you say, the two are not that far apart on the issue itself.
No, they're really not. I think that I think what Kerry has a problem is that he has maybe a more nuanced approach to it. Although, from what the president said this morning, it sounds like he also has a nuanced approach. Although, you could also argue that a constitutional amendment is pretty black and white. But it's also very hard to get.
Well, tell me about that. How likely is gay marriage? 38 states and the federal government have actually already approved laws or amendments barring gay marriage. How tough is it to pull this off? How does it work?
It's not going to happen before November, I'll tell you that. Amending the Constitution is a very difficult task, and it takes years. First, you have to get two-thirds of the House of Representatives to pass it and two-thirds of the Senate. And because of the way the Democratic-Republican split is in those two chambers, I think that would be very tough if the Democrats hang together on this, which is not to say that they would. I think you'll find some conservative Democrats who would go along with this, but that's very hard. And then if you get it out of Congress, it has to be ratified by three-quarters of the 50 states. And that hasn't been done in a very long time. The last time that an amendment to the Constitution got to the states was the Equal Rights Amendment back in the 70s, and that went it didn't get the number of votes, and it's not part of our Constitution.
You know, Andrea, Democratic strategist Doug Hathaway, who was Al Gore's press spokesperson, said on this program recently that he thought the Democrats would just try to avoid this issue in the elections.
This is not what they want to talk about. Mm. They were really having a good time talking about jobs and health care and the economy, and those are the issues that that Democrats care about. I think there was another report came out today that showed consumer confidence took a plunge. So that's really something that the Democrats want to concentrate on. The gay marriage is part of the culture wars, and Democrats don't want to go near the culture wars.
USA Today's Andrea Stone joined us from Washington, D.C. Andrea, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Bill.
Well, just a month before the Russian election, Russian President Vladimir Putin today dismissed his prime minister along with the entire rest of his cabinet. Putin is running virtually unopposed. He's assured to win a second term. So why the massive sacking? Joining us on the line from Moscow is David Filipov of the Boston Globe. Welcome, David.
Hello. How are you?
So, David, who did Vladimir Putin act against? He's dismissed his entire government.
Right. He dismissed his entire government, but the man that he's trying to remove here is the Prime Minister, Mikhail Kasyanov. In order to do that, according to Russian law, Mr. Putin has to dismiss the entire government. But Kasyanov has been the one that Putin has wanted to get rid of, and this is obviously his move to do it.
Why did he want to get rid of him?
Kasyanov is one of the last major officials in Russia still associated with the presidency of Boris Yeltsin, the man who was in power when Putin was coming up to power. Kasyanov has spoken out strongly against some of Putin's most public moves, including the arrest of the famous oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And so Putin wanted to clean house before the elections that are coming up next month.
How will voters react?
Well, everything Putin does seems to make him more popular. Right now, by making this move, he's saying, people, you're not voting for the old Yeltsin regime anymore. You're voting for me. I've just gotten rid of the last vestiges of Boris Yeltsin's old regime, his connection to the old oligarchic tycoons. Now you're voting for Putin, you're voting for me and no one else. That's bound to do nothing but increase his popularity.
Does it sharpen, David, do you think, Putin's image as an increasingly autocratic head of state, or is this simply allowable under the Russian Constitution and doesn't necessarily diminish Russian democracy in any way?
Well, can the answer be yes in both cases? Because on the one hand, it's all completely legal according to Russia's Constitution. On the other hand, what has Putin done? He's going to appoint a new prime minister. We don't know who that is, but there is some indication it will be somebody from his close circle of confidants, perhaps Sergei Ivanov, also a former KGB agent who is now the minister of defense. Now that's just speculation, of course, but whomever Putin appoints, that candidate will slide right through the new parliament, which was elected in December, because the parliament is made up almost entirely of Putin supporters. So basically, Putin can do whatever he wants, even though it's formally still very democratic what he's doing.
The election is March 14th. Putin is running virtually unopposed, right?
That's right. And the few candidates whose popularity taken together probably doesn't amount up to 10% complain that they are getting unfair treatment, not enough airtime. That's all probably true, but they can't really do anything about it. Now they're talking about a boycott, but even that would not prevent Putin from a landslide victory.
David Filipov of the Boston Globe joined us from Moscow. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jordanian officials testified today at The Hague against the wall Israel's building on the West Bank, a barrier Israel says is meant to keep out Palestinian terrorists. It's the second day of hearings at the International Court of Justice, which is the UN's highest judicial body. Palestinians argued yesterday before the court that the fence, as Israel calls it, is not about security, but is in fact a land grab, since the wall intrudes deep into the West Bank in places. But on Sunday, 8 Israelis died in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem. Israel says had the wall been completed there, the attack could not have happened. Joining us on the line is BBC reporter Geraldine Coughlin from The Hague. Welcome, Geraldine.
Hi, Bill.
Geraldine, the wall on the West Bank is about a quarter complete, as you know. It's made up of trenches and walls and razor wire, and some estimate it could be as long as 450 miles when completed. But Israelis, very much across the board, say they need it for security. What are the arguments you're hearing at The Hague against this wall?
Today we heard a very powerful presentation from Jordan, who's heading the Arab states that support the Palestinian case. And Jordan is now arguing that it's afraid of an exodus of refugees from the West Bank if the situation gets any worse. The delegation was led by Jordan's ambassador to the UN, and he said that his country already hosts a lot of refugees and displaced persons, and that any influx of refugees would be destabilizing.
talking about the Middle East, Geraldine, and it's somewhat incongruous setting, isn't it? They're in wigs and waistcoats at the International Court of Justice, aren't they?
Yes, it is quite a contradictory situation. It's very austere, this old Gothic building that's known as the Peace Palace here. And 15 judges from all different countries sit across a very, very wide bench in this Baroque hall, wearing lace collars and these black gowns. And they look very serious as they listen intently to the different presentations. The presentations are very professional. They have international legal experts at the highest level making presentations for these delegations. The Palestinian presentation in particular was very powerful, and it was presented by professors from Belgium, from Switzerland, and from Great Britain. And it was also headed by the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations. So it's at a very, very high level, and it is very impressive.
What is the sense there as to why Israel didn't send anyone there, only submitted written arguments?
They're arguing that the International Court of Justice is not the proper forum to hear this case. They say it's a political issue and it should be resolved within the framework of negotiations in respect of the roadmap peace plan. Now, Israel, on the other hand, has sent an observer delegation from the government, which is present at the hearings they're observing, and they're making statements to journalists. They're saying that the hearings at the World Court are one-sided because they don't take Palestinian terrorism into consideration. So we are getting both sides of the argument at the court, even though Israel isn't involved in making any oral submissions.
The Israeli position very much backed up by the United States. Now, the hearings conclude tomorrow, Geraldine. What happens then?
Tomorrow we're expecting to hear submissions from Sudan, the League of Arab States, and the Organization of the Islamic Conference. And I think this is going to be interesting because of the presentations from the Arab states. This is really going to be something which will back up the Palestinian case. One interesting point to note is that Turkey was supposed to make oral submissions on Wednesday. Now they have withdrawn at the last minute without explanation. As you know, Turkey wants to become a member of the European Union. European Union members have stayed away because they say that the court is not the proper forum to hear the case.
Geraldine, just to finish up, a decision, as I understand it, not expected from the International Court of Justice for at least a year. What could happen if the decision goes against Israel?
What happens then is that that decision will be encompassed into international law. Then it goes back to the UN General Assembly, and they will analyse this and decide how to use it in determining the direction they will take in the future with regard to the Middle East peace process.
Geraldine Coughlin is a reporter for the BBC. She spoke to us from The Hague. Geraldine, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Just ahead, organic milk or just the regular old kind? We go down on the farm to see if the cows are any different. And later in the show, a victim of clergy sex abuse is dead. We look back at the troubled life of Patrick McSorley. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. A still small but growing number of American consumers are turning to organic food. Sales of organics have been growing by 20% a year and are projected to hit $16 billion in sales this year. But organic food generally costs more than its conventional counterparts. So what are consumers paying for with the extra dollars? This week on Here and Now, we're looking at one staple in American refrigerators, milk. And today, producer Alan Cockle compares two farms, one conventional and the other organic.
Vermont is dairy country. 1,400 farms, nearly a million gallons of milk a day. But behind the numbers is an industry operating on tight margins, with more milk coming from fewer cows and fewer farms every year. And as elsewhere in American agriculture, many farmers are choosing to go big or get out. Just south of Bradford, in the good land of the Connecticut River Valley, is Newmont Farm, owned by Margaret and Walter Gladstone. The house and the old hip-roof barn stand to one side. Across the road is a gleaming milking parlor and two giant new barns, the heart of the modern operation.
So this barn out here was built 3 years ago. We built it with not necessarily the people in mind, but more of the cow comfort in mind.
Margaret and Walt Gladstone milk more than 600 cows. Their barns are big, clean, and efficient. Overhead fans draw in a continuous supply of fresh air, and the cows, black and white Holsteins, are free to stand, lie down, and mill about where they like.
So if you look around, all these beds have sand bedding in them, which is the best thing out there as far as cow comfort.
So they lay in loose sand?
They lay in loose sand, and sand is put in there once a week. It's expensive, but it saves cows.
The cows are fed corn silage, fermented hay, and grain, and once a week a nutritionist visits to optimize their diet. Every 2 weeks, these cows get a shot of BST, or bovine growth hormone. Everything here is calculated to maximize production.
Come on, girls. Come on.
In the milking parlor, Gene Welch, one of the farm's 11 full-time employees, cracks a wooden cane on the concrete floor. The cows, their udders distended, seem to waddle as they take up their places, 32 at a time, for milking.
Just tell me what you're doing.
I just gave her a shot. We got two slow cows here. We usually get them started first.
On a small table at the end of the parlor are vials of drugs. Oxytocin, a hormone to speed up the slow milkers, and penicillin for treating udder infections.
How long does it take to milk one cow?
Well, some cows milk out 2 or 3 minutes, some cows take 10 minutes, some cows take 20 minutes.
The milk of cows on antibiotics is not for human consumption and is carefully separated. The rest flows to the cooler next door. These cows average 10 gallons per cow a day, though some produce double that. 20 miles west, just south of the town of Tunbridge, up a side road and through a covered bridge, is another farm. This one is organic, and with just 34 cows, it has a very different approach to business.
Much smaller milk house than what you saw at Gladstone's, and we ship about a ton a day, basically, and that generates enough cash flow to meet my needs.
Rob Howe milks his cows in a 120-year-old barn, a dimly lit, low-ceilinged space. Three barn cats look on as he wheels an old wooden cart the length of the barn, tossing each animal a scoop of food.
This is a combination of cornmeal, soybean meal.
The feed here is produced without chemical pesticides or fertilizers, but it's otherwise similar to the feed at a conventional farm. Organic also means not using hormones to increase pregnancy rates or milk production, and not using antibiotics to treat sick cows, including the udder infections that are common in the dairy industry. In the summer, these cows must have access to the outdoors, though right now, in the winter, they spend most of their time in the barn. And unlike the Gladstone farm, these cows are held in place, their heads secured by metal stanchions. Once again, these are Holsteins, but here they produce 30 to 40% less milk. Rob Howe can afford to farm this way, in part because of the premium he's been paid since switching 9 years ago from conventional farming to organic.
I certainly would like to say that the only reason I'm doing it is because of the issues concerning conventional versus organic wisdom, but I do have a bigger profit margin as an organic dairy farmer rather than conventional. And so that has to be the number one reason.
The organic industry does not claim that organic milk is different in any way from milk produced from conventional farms. But Nat Bacon, the dairy advisor for the Northeast Organic Farm Association of Vermont, does believe that the cows themselves are better off.
Under a high production system, dairy farmers are really forced to, a lot of times, treat their animals very intensively. It puts a lot of stress on the animals who are making a lot of milk. And in the United States, the average lifespan for a dairy cow is about 4 years old on average when she goes to slaughter. Under more low-stress systems, like an organic system, cows tend to last longer and not so many metabolic and digestive problems as they do under conventional system.
But Chris Galen with the National Milk Producers Federation, a dairy industry umbrella group, says that not using antibiotics is a potential problem.
One of the ironies, of course, with organic production is because farmers choose not to use conventional antibiotic products that are available to conventional producers. A lot of times, I think cows that might be treatable through veterinary care on a conventional farm may actually have to be slaughtered on an organic operation because you can't treat them the way you normally would.
Conventional or organic, dairy farmers don't stay in business unless they sell their milk for more than it costs to produce. So the consumer is left to decide, will I pay more to support a particular approach to agriculture? The two farms we visited today aren't necessarily representative of all conventional and organic farms. Just as there are 1,000 cow organic operations, there are thousands of small, family-run conventional farms where the production is less intensive. And for those who believe that all farms should convert to organic, Rob Howe in Tunbridge has a message.
Well, I hope it stays in the niche market because certainly the laws of supply and demand would come into effect. That would be horrible for my situation. I wouldn't be too crazy about lots of people getting certified and then being way more milk than we could have a demand for.
For images of the farms Alan Coggle visited, go to our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow, we look at the debate over a controversial hormone banned in Europe and Canada. It's in widespread use on American dairy farms. That's tomorrow. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. A long-awaited Vatican report on clergy sex abuse emphatically rejects the American Church's new zero-tolerance policy for offenders. While the American policy requires defrocking priests found guilty of sexual abuse, the panel in Rome says zero tolerance could result in pedophiles being released into society at large, where they can do more damage. Joining us to discuss the new papal guidelines is John Allen, who covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Bill.
John, good morning to you. Welcome. The new report is supposed to serve as a guideline, John, for churches, but it rejects the American policy of zero tolerance. First, on what grounds does it reject the American policy?
Well, first of all, reject may be putting it a little strongly. I mean, this is not a juridical document. This is a collection of papers that were presented at a Vatican symposium last April, and so they are, in that sense, no surprise. This was a gathering of leading experts on sexual abuse drawn from the world of science rather than the world of religion. These actually all happen to be non-Catholics, and they were surprisingly unanimous in what they told the Vatican officials, which is that a blanket policy of kicking men out of the priesthood for even one act of sexual abuse could, in effect, put the community more at risk. That is, it could put priests, in this case now ex-priests, back into the community with no means of support and in high-stress situations, putting them in context in which they're actually more likely rather than less likely to abuse. So their advice was that if the church is sincerely concerned primarily about avoiding future acts of abuse, in some cases it might be better to have a more flexible approach.
Well, John, given all that, is this likely to modify American how American churches handle all this?
Well, you know, the American norms, which are the rules, in effect, under which they're applying discipline to priests who are accused of sex abuse, have an expiration. They were approved by the Vatican for a two-year period, and their expiration date is March 2005, which means sometime during this year of 2004, the U.S. bishops will have to start the process of asking for an extension if they intend to keep that program, and every indication is that they do. And that means that they will have to sit down with the Vatican and talk this out. And there is every indication that officials in the Vatican are interested in taking another look at this one-strike policy for these reasons and also for reasons of elemental justice. I mean, there are some Vatican officials who think that in some cases where you have an offense that is perhaps from 30 or 40 years in the past and of a relatively minor nature and no evidence of other offenses since, that perhaps such an individual ought to be allowed to continue in ministry in some cases. And so certainly this will be on the table when the Vatican and the U.S. bishops talk.
But, John, isn't any strike against the one strike and you're out policy likely to outrage victims of abuse, victims, advocates, and so on?
Oh, no question of that. I mean, obviously the victims groups in this country are already suspicious of the Church for being soft on issues of abuse and for coddling abuser priests and the bishops who covered up for them. Any move to soften the one strike policy is certainly bound to deepen those suspicions, and so it certainly is going to be controversial.
Anything else in the report, John, besides the emphasis on the zero-tolerance policy?
Yeah, I think the other thing probably of interest is that these scientific experts delivered a clear message to the Vatican that homosexuality in and of itself is not a causal factor in producing sexual abuse. There had been some talk in the Vatican about adopting a policy banning gays from seminaries in the wake of the sex abuse crisis, and this message from the experts seemed to have stopped that move in its tracks.
Would that perhaps, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, mean that the Church recognizes that many gay men are interested in joining the priesthood?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody who's an authority in the Church is blind to the fact that there is a certain percentage of gays in the priesthood, and some of them are extraordinarily faithful priests doing very good work. And I think this advice from the experts that homosexuality in and of itself does not prompt abuse has probably given those people who are sympathetic an additional argument not to clamp down on gays in the priesthood.
John Allen covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. John, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure, Bill.
If there's a single face of a victim of clergy sex abuse, it would probably be the strikingly handsome face of Patrick McSorley. When silence still prevailed among most victims of predatory priests, McSorley spoke out again and again about the abuse he suffered at the hands of his family's trusted priest, John Gagan. Yesterday morning, Patrick McSorley was found dead in a Boston apartment. He was 29 years old. Attorney Mitchell Garabedian represented Patrick McSorley and knew him well. He joins us on the line from his office in Boston. Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
Mitchell, why did Patrick McSorley speak out when so many still could not?
Patrick was outraged at what the Church allowed to happen to innocent children. Patrick was outraged that not only pedophile priests would commit such evil acts, such as molesting innocent children, but the supervisors would allow those acts to occur time and time and time again.
Tell us about him.
Patrick was a very honest person who loved children, who loved life, who treasured his family. He cared much about his son, and he just didn't want this evil to exist anymore. He was just an honest person, a happy, forthright person.
A very troubled guy, though, too.
Well, so many victims of clergy sexual abuse carry around painful baggage that money can't help dissolve, painful baggage that they have to deal with day to day.
He was known to have had problems with drugs and alcohol. His own father was a suicide. What do you know about his death?
Well, his own father committed suicide, and that opened the door for Father Gagan to molest Patrick. Father Gagan went to the house to offer his condolences, and he took Patrick out for an ice cream at that point in time, and under the guise of taking him out for an ice cream, he molested Patrick.
What do you make of his death? What have you learned about what may have killed Patrick McSorley? It's still unknown.
It's my understanding that the police department is conducting an investigation. It was obvious that Patrick was in a lot of pain. But ironically, last Friday at 3:30, I spoke to Patrick because Patrick wanted to come into my office and meet me this week, as a matter of fact, so that he could support victims of clergy sexual abuse whose cases haven't resolved. Patrick sounded cheerful and he sounded happy and he wanted to lend his encouragement to those victims.
Mm. What impact, Mitchell, in the end, do you think his presence on so many TV screens and on radio and in newspapers have on the Church's policy the change in the church's policy toward abusive clergy?
Well, there's two ways of looking at that. First of all, I don't know if the church is going to change to a large degree. They're such a secret society, and they're so immobile in their ways. One has to question what they're really going to do in reality in terms of changing. But secondly, Patrick has been very, very influential in helping the public understand the tragedy involved in clergy sexual abuse. And now the public is going to more carefully watch its children, and I believe the public now will prevent its children from being sexually molested by clergy members.
The Catholic Church in Boston has expressed grief, even a degree of anguish, I think, at the death of Patrick McSorley.
Oh, yes, they have, and there are good priests out there, and unfortunately those good priests are tainted by the bad priests, and I'm sure the words of the Catholic Church are appreciated by Patrick's family.
Yeah. Mitchell Garabedian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Attorney Mitchell Garabedian represented Patrick McSorley, and knew him well. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please do tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, the new film, Robot Stories. You're listening to Here and Now. You get an email from someone asking for money to help them move a huge amount of money internationally. You're promised a small fortune if everything works out. But it's the Nigerian email scam known as 419 fraud, named for the Nigerian law that makes it possible. For the first time, Nigeria is moving against some of the ripoff artists. Joining us is Audrey Lanford of scambusters.org. Welcome, Audrey.
Great to be here, Bill.
Audrey, for those of us unacquainted with these emails, care to share an excerpt from one of your favorites?
Sure. It starts off, urgent response needed, very common headline. Dear Sir, Madam, I write you this not because I know you or anything else, my favorite part, but because I would like to establish a relationship which would enable us a further business deal. Who I am, I will not disclose right away. Because I fear for my job. So I hope you will bear with me.
And then they say that they've been sort of, they've had a problem obtaining some money, and if you help them obtain the money, right, they will give you a fee?
They'll give you typically between 20 and 30% of the $10 to $80 million.
And it's just that now they're finally cracking down on 419 fraud, these arrests that we're seeing.
Yeah, we're starting to see a drop in the bucket.
It is
such a drop.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, such a drop.
Why did Nigeria decide to crack down, even in as small a way as you say it is?
The Nigerians are really complaining that the rest of the world is painting them as dishonest and so on. And I think there was just an enormous amount of pressure. Part of the problem is it's not just money that's being lost here. It's also not just identity theft, which is even worse.
Yeah.
But people have been killed, they've been kidnapped, and they've been missing. And so when you start to have,
How do you get to killing and kidnapping from this?
Well, what happens is in the last phases of this, a trip to Nigeria is required for the closing.
Oh.
And at that point, they con you into believing you don't need a visa, which is, in fact, illegal. So once you get there, they get you in with no problem. But once you get into the country, then they bribe you and they extort you, actually, to get you out, keep you out of prison, et cetera.
Audrey, why would anyone fall for this? And how many have?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how many have, but over $1 billion has been lost to this scam. So it's a huge, huge problem. They estimate between 100 and 200 million a year at this point. And, it's a really interesting question. Why would people fall for this? I mean, when you read these emails, you think, oh, my gosh, how could anybody believe this? I think it's the fact that they start to envision themselves with the millions of dollars. And then, what's $5,000 or $10,000 when you're going to have $7 million?
Yeah, the dream is just too alluring.
It is.
And Audrey, you're suggesting that this isn't going away despite the so-called Nigerian crackdown.
Oh, there's no way this is going away. This is a huge, huge thing that's been going on actually for decades.
Well, thanks, Audrey, for making our listeners more aware of it. I guess anybody who gets such an email, obviously, ignore it.
Absolutely.
Audrey Lanford of scambusters.org joined us from Boone, North Carolina. Thanks a lot, Audrey.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. When you first start watching the four short films that make up the new film, Robot Stories, you realize a couple of things pretty quickly. You're in the future, for one thing, though not so far away from our own time that anyone's dressed in funny, futuristic outfits. And you note that most of the actors and actresses happen to be Asian Americans. So we're in the realm of a category of film you won't typically find at your local multiplex, Asian American sci-fi. But whatever genre bending's going on, the themes in Robot Stories rapidly become universal. We're joined now by Greg Pak, writer and director of Robot Stories. And Greg, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Greg, the four stories are Robot Baby, then The Robot Fixer, Machine Love, and Clay. All of them about technology, synthetic humans, and the relationship of all that to the human heart. Before we get to why you chose this theme, let's hear a quick cut from the first film, Robot Baby, where a couple looking to adopt a human child have to go through a trial period with a robot equivalent.
He has the G9 processor, which means he'll learn and grow. He'll become his own little person based largely on his experiences with you. So you want to treat Bobby the way you would a human baby. Hold him, talk to him, play with him. In short, love him. His hard drive will record all of the nurturing you give, so when we download at the end of the month, we'll be able to see how well you cared for him.
The baby in question is a cute little pink egg of a robot. What were you trying to do here?
Well, the robot is egg-shaped because when I was growing up in Dallas, Texas, all the kids in the high school health class had to carry around a little wicker basket with an egg inside of it. And I think that was part of a hey, kids, don't get pregnant kind of campaign. But it was supposed to teach you about taking care of something. And so it occurred to me this question of, like, a couple that wants to have a baby first has to take care of a robot baby. And, of course, it had to be egg-shaped.
Now, the robot fixer. Here, the robots seem almost incidental. They're little toys. This is the most poetic story.
Yeah, this is the story of a mother whose adult son is in a coma. This is a son she never really knew. And now she's trying to figure out what her whole relationship with him is about. And she becomes obsessed with completing his old robot toy collection.
Very tender film.
Yeah, and Wai Ching Ho, who's the actress who plays the lead in that story, is just tremendous. I mean, I love this actress so much. And she's won a couple of awards for her performance, including Best Actress from the St. Louis International Film Festival.
The larger theme of Robot Stories, why this tension throughout all these films between the human heart and technology?
Well, I've loved robot stories for years. I mean, I grew up reading Ray Bradbury and watching Twilight Zone and that kind of classic sci-fi where you would take these sort of fantastic elements of robots or spaceships or whatever it was and combine it with sort of genuine human emotion was wildly compelling to me as a kid. For me personally, these stories were relevant because during the time I was writing them, I was going through a lot and had lost a few people who were close to me and sort of became more aware of human frailty, I guess.
And also one of the films, the concluding film, is very much about mortality. It's called Clay, about a dying sculptor who's offered immortality, but digital immortality. Let's hear a clip where his son is talking about the benefits of having his brain patterns scanned and downloaded and stored into a computer so everything his consciousness has ever experienced will always exist.
Once you're scanned, you just visualize stuff, you know? It shows up on screens, in the databases. They get instant blueprints.
That's ridiculous.
It works.
Not for me.
You know, one thing I noted in these films is none of it seems that far-fetched. Now, part of it may be that everybody's dressed in a very contemporary way. It seems to be in a very contemporary New York City. But you're not pushing us into places that seem completely from left field.
Yeah, I did improv comedy for years and years and years, and one of the principles of improv comedy was, you know, when you get a penguin in the room, you have enough strange stuff. You know, like the first weird thing that comes into the room is what the scene becomes about. So each of the stories in Robot Stories has one crazy thing. There's a robot baby. There's scanning technology, you know, that will give you digital immortality. In another story, there's android office workers, which are programmed to interact and learn and develop emotions.
And you play one of those robots. What
yes.
made you decide to... act?
Well, like I said, I'd done improv comedy for many years yeah. and had always, you know, had this, you know, I've got a, you know, I'm a whore for attention. So, you know, I always kind of secretly wanted to put myself in a film. But I didn't want to put myself into something that I wasn't ready for. The other sort of thing about that particular story was that I knew from the beginning that I wanted to cast those androids with mixed race actors. And I'm biracial. I'm half Korean and half white. And I wanted to do that for a few reasons. One, because I wanted them to look distinctive from everybody else, because that's sort of part of the whole subtext of that story. And also because I wanted them to, because I think when they actually make robots that look like people, they're going to make them racially ambiguous, that they'll want to be able to market them in as many different territories as possible, you know, so they can sell them in South America and Japan.
This is not your first Asian American film either. Asian pride porn.
Yes.
What is that all about?
It's a crazy little short film, an infomercial spoof with Tony Award-winning playwright David Henry Hwang hawking progressive pornography.
Now, if you like pornography, you know all about Asian or Oriental porn.
Oriental blossoms, where every flower's ripe for plucking. Give me a call. I'm waiting. Hello.
Sure, it'll do in a pinch. But when I'm feeling lonely and bored, I don't need guilt over the sexual oppression of women of color and anger about the absence / emasculation of the Asian male in American media to add to my shame of masturbation and societally induced self-loathing. So, imagine my pleasant surprise when I discovered Asian pride porn. Positive images of confident Asian American men and women caught on tape in the hottest hardcore action currently legal in North America.
That's funny and daring stuff.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction did you get to that from Asian American audience in particular?
Oh, people ate it up. I mean, people love that. Because, you know, the thing is, there's a lot of anger. You know what I mean? People get angry about the... you know, sort of constant bad ways in which Asians tend to be depicted. It's like when you see an Asian person on screen, oftentimes they're just comic relief or they're just in the background. I mean, there's almost never a point when, or they're used symbolically mm-hmm. to represent nobility or to represent evil or avarice. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, it's just tiresome to be used as a symbol for somebody else's story. And why not just, you know, why not just have them as leads, just as normal people? I mean, I think that's it with Robot Stories. The thing that makes me happy about Robot Stories and seeing it with audiences is that folks from all kinds of different backgrounds, it's played around the country, around the world, and people who may never even have met an Asian person in their life watch the movie, totally identify with the characters, fall in love with the characters, feel the emotions they're feeling. And I think that's one of the great great things about movie making is that it's an emotional experience, and people can lose themselves in other people's experiences, identify with other people, and walk away with maybe, even on a subconscious level, a different way of looking at the world.
But, Greg, you're a talented young filmmaker. You've won a whole bunch of awards for things you've done, including for Robot Stories. When do you turn a corner toward films that are not necessarily limited to an Asian-American cast or Asian-American themes? Do you do that? Or?
Well, frankly, I think Robot Stories is a film that isn't limited, you know? I mean,
But it's certainly Asian-American actors and actresses throughout.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the way I think about it is, I wrote a movie with called MVP, which premiered at Sundance this year, and it's an African-American cast set in Detroit. And I'm writing for hire a project for Antidote Films, which is a largely white cast. And, you know, I mean, if it's a good story, I'm very happy to work on it. At the same time, I want to live in a world where a good story with Asian-American characters is accepted, you know, where people will go see that the same way they'll go see a movie with Italian-Americans or Irish-Americans, you know. I mean, I kind of think that, like, you know, Brothers McMullen was a movie with a largely Irish-American cast, which was fine. People accepted it. Like Big Fat Greek Wedding, people accepted that. I think Robot Stories is being – the exciting thing for me is seeing movies like Robot Stories – being accepted the same way. You know, we just had this killer opening weekend in New York, and, you know, I looked around the audience, and it's this totally mixed audience. I mean, a lot of Asian Americans.
And I must say, when you watch it, at first you're a bit struggled, oh, they're all Asian Americans. Well, you forget it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Greg Pak is writer and director and distributor of Robot Stories. Greg Pak, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more information on Robot Stories and where you can see it, please go to our website at here-now.org. Come on, mama, now get along. I know that daddy's been treating you wrong. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. Hey, mama, hey, come along with me.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.